I'm Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. I welcome you again to this now third session of our ongoing conference on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region. It's my pleasure to introduce our moderator today, David M. Lampton, professor emeritus and former Hyman professor and director of CICE China and China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and recently distinguished visitor here at the Asia Pacific Research Center at Stanford as well. Professor Lampton, or Mike as his friends call him, served as Dean of Faculty at CICE from 2004 to 2012, and also as President of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations from 1988 to 1997. He's the author of a dozen books and monographs on China's politics, its global affairs, and U.S.-China relations, including Rivers of Iron, Railroads and Chinese Power in Southeast Asia, The Three Faces of Chinese Power, Might, Money, and Mines, and Following the Leader, Ruling China from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping. Many of you are quite familiar with Mike Lampton, but I'm going to tell you in closing something you may not know about him that I didn't know until I closely examined his bio, and which well positions him to moderate academic and international debates. He served with the Stanford Fire Department during his senior year as an undergraduate at Stanford, and I imagine that events on campus kept him pretty busy as a fireman that year. So, Mike, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I trust I'm hooked up here, and thank you for that gracious introduction. And let me tell you, being a fireman was great training for dealing with U.S.-China relations and associated topics. So it actually was critical to my development. It's really my pleasure to moderate this session, the broad integrative topic of which is the challenges and opportunities of economic interdependence primarily. We have three excellent speakers and one and paper writers and one excellent discussant. So I'll get out of the way as quickly as I can and just briefly introduce people because you have their written bios in more thorough form. And we'll go in the order that I introduce people. Dr. Christine Lai is research fellow at the Institute of Political Science at Academica Sinica. She's formerly taught at Johns Hopkins, my own school, and she's done a paper on China's economic coercion against East Asia. Second speaker is going to be Dr. Ian Zung-Yen Chun, is associate professor at the Institute of Political Science at Sun Yat-sen University. He's written on the AAIB, and also his paper today is on the new southbound policy framework and economic security. Each of them will speak for about 10 minutes, and I have to be a fairly stringent officer of the law here. So if people would stay to 10 minutes, I'd appreciate it. And then Dr. Tom Finger, who was the first deputy director of the National Director of National Intelligence, and is now at APARC as a senior fellow, Shorenstein APARC fellow. He's going to comment for about 10 minutes. And then we'll have a discussion among the panelists and involving Tom and myself. And then we'll throw it open for 15 minutes at the end to general Q&A. Also, I think it may be that you have a couple minutes more than 10 minutes, the paper writer. So first, Dr. Christine Lai.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Christina Lai, and it's certainly my pleasure to share my words on Chinese foreign policy and East Asian security with the faculty member and student at Stanford University. And ever since China has launched its major reforms in its domestic and international policy in the late 1970s, it has gone through a significant rise in its economic development and military modernization. And this has led to debates in both academia and policy circle about whether China will pose a threat to the United States and its regional allies in Asia. And over the last decade, China has punished countries that undermine its territorial claims with measures such as restricting trade, encouraging popular boycotts, and cutting up Chinese tourism. These coercive measures has certainly caused significant economic damage to U.S. Partners such as Japan, Philippines, Taiwan, and South Korea. And China's economic coercion may have long-term effects in deterring and shaping countries' foreign policy interests that goes well beyond the short-term economic cost. So actually, in my report that I presented for this conference, Japan and Taiwan have responded to Chinese coercive economic measure by identifying alternative market and through securitizing its economic policy. And looking into the future, country targeted by Chinese unilateral coercive measure will probably adopt these two policy in responding to Beijing's action. So let me just briefly talk about the current China-Taiwan relations. And China certainly has a long track record of using coercive economic measure against Taiwan. And since the 1990s, China has also tried to influence Taiwan's election and use economic measure to gain support for Taiwanese business leader. And Beijing recently employed these tools after the election of President Tsai Ing-wen and her pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party, specifically in response to Tsai's election. China cut off group tourism to this island through a series of diversification initiatives. Taiwan has succeeded in replacing the loss of tourism, primarily with the visitor from Southeast Asia, though it did not fully recover the revenue loss from a Chinese visitor. And when the President Tsai and the DPP won overwhelmingly in the 2016 election, the Taiwanese governments have actively addressed China's economic and security threats to Taiwan's democratic value. The Tsai administration has gained legitimacy through securitizing China-Taiwan trade. And President Tsai was able to convince the general public that over-reliance on China's economy could be detrimental to Taiwan's democratic system. And so the greater vulnerability perceived by the Taiwan, the greater pressures on the Taiwanese government to hedge against China's threats. And the concrete policy measure will include diversifying Taiwan's economy to seek alternative markets in other Asian countries and pursuing stronger security tie with the United States and promote local identity in face of a more accepted China. And so far, during President Tsai's tenure from 2016 until now, Taiwan's strategy in responding to China's coercive measure has been focusing on raising the public awareness, exposing the risk in which Beijing economic leverage has placed on Taiwan. And so far, I think the securitization policy proved to be an effective one in countering China's economic coercion as the Taiwanese government attempt to lessen its dependence on China's economy. And now move to another case in study for my report is China-Japan relation. And Japan is the only country targeted by the Chinese coercive economic measure to actually bring a WTO challenge in response. And Japan, joined by the United United States and the EU have won its WTO challenge against China's rare earth exports restriction, when the WTO concluded that Beijing's measure has violated a global trade rule. And although China has put an end to such an export quota after losing the case at the WTO, I think its foreign reputation was negatively affected. And China claimed for environmental protection and human safety for this export quota on rare earth material was not justified. And this because this quota was against the principle of non-discrimination of the WTO obligation. So China seemingly noble justification for this export restriction has turned out to be perceived negatively by the West and the WTO. Because they considered this coercive measure as a tool to gain China's national interests. So in this sense, China's use of rare earth material against Japan has created mixed result and for the short-term and long-term consequences. And China might have taught Japan a lesson by showing how vulnerable its economy could be. But at the same time, China also suffered from losing face in international organization. And in response to China's coercive measure, I think Japan has adopted a diversification strategy. And specifically, Japan, Australia, and the US, they have teamed up together to diversify their source of rare earth material. And specifically, the Japan oil, the Japanese government have started to financing the state-owned company, such as Japan Oil, Gas Metal National Corporation, and in establishing processing and extraction facility for rare earth material. And as the US-China trade war has certainly increased the risk awareness about the stability of supplies in the rare earth metal, the US still heavily relies on China's processing of this metal. Therefore, the Trump administration now has seek to maintain its domestic supply and processing to hedge China's economic coercion. For example, Mountain Pass, a rare earth mine situated in California, has already resumed in operation in production. So developing the supply and processing chain in the US would help diversify the source if China were to halt export of rare earth material again. And I think even though there's still a long way to go to limit China's dominance on the rare earth material, these countries, right, Japan and Australia and the US have raised their awareness in deterring Beijing from weaponizing this leverage in the near future. And developing a stronger partnership with countries in the Asia-Pacific region will not only improve the global supply chain for rare earth material, but also help build up the resilience against China economic coercion. So as China's tools of economic coercion are diverse and increasingly frequent, and ranging from the termination of energy supply, a suspension of export material or a trade restriction on import goods, a systematic understanding of the strategic nature of Chinese foreign policy is certainly an important research topic for both academia and community and for policy circle. And so the finding of my article has significant implication for both policy and theory. Until now, China is highly selective in choosing the instrument of economic coercion because it has always refrained from damaging its own domestic economy. And it is exactly the reason why China's exit option have led to the responding strategy from Japan and Taiwan in countering this economic coercion. And given the growing awareness, I think Asian countries are in a better position when they adopt a securitization policy for their national economy and also diversifying their trading partner. And finally, I will conclude my presentation by saying that the dynamic between Beijing's coercive measure and China's neighbor's response can offer a way of thinking about foreign policy objective and the effectiveness of economic coercion and China's image management strategy. Thank you, everyone here.
Well, thank you very much, Christina. And I thought the concepts of securitization and diversification are extremely helpful, and I'm sure we'll come back to that repeatedly. So thank you. Now we have Dr. Chen, and I misspoke. You have 15 minutes.
So good morning, everyone from Taiwan. My name is Ian Chen, and thanks for Professor Lampton's introduction and also the Hoover Institution for inviting me to participate in this conference. I'm going to share my thought about Taiwan's new southbound policy, Xin Nan Xiang Zheng Che, or NSB. This initiative was proposed by Tsai Ing-wen when she was running for the Taiwan president in 2015. And after Tsai won for the presidency, the NSB was officially launched in September 2016. And the NSB framework aims to enhance cooperation and exchange between Taiwan and 18 countries in Southeast Asia, South Asia, Australia, and New Zealand. And my following presentation will focus on how can the NSP improve Taiwan's economic security and see if there's any evidence showing that the NSP has indeed been effective in improving Taiwan's economic security. Well, so first of all, what is economic security? In this paper, I'll focus on international level of economic security. And I do not look at the domestic economic performance. So in the setting of this paper, a country can sustain a higher level of economic security if its external economic relationship is favorable to its economic development, as well as it can better adjust itself to policy changes made by its foreign counterparts. And economic security is not only about increasing a country's absolute economic performance. It is probably more important for a country to also improving its capability to shield against the fast changes of external environments. So a country will be less capable of adjusting itself to a fast changing world and become more economically insecure if it depends too much on a small number of countries and if the interdependent relationship is asymmetrical. So in the context of Taiwan, its economic security depends on whether it situates itself in the asymmetrical economic interdependent relationship in the world. More specifically, it is crucial to see whether Taiwan over-concentrates its external economic ties on just a few countries, especially a friendly country that is likely to alter and even sever economic exchanges in the upcoming future. So Taiwan is a trading country. The total export accounts for about 60% of the GDP. And as a trading country, international trade and FDI are crucial for Taiwan's economic security. Well, it is no secret that Taiwan so far depends heavily on China. China's market consumes a dominant amount of products and semi-products made in Taiwan. Chinese society also attracts a large amount of capitals, technology, and entrepreneurship coming from Taiwan. So the amount of tourists rationed by Beijing also affect Taiwan's domestic economic performance. In a nutshell, Taiwan's economic security lies in its economic relationship with China, especially in trade, FDI, and tourism. It appears that at present, the situation of Taiwan's economic security is affected by excessive dependence on China. However, China is not so dependent on Taiwan. As a result, for Taiwan to be free from such structural constraints, here comes the NSP, which is seen by many as a framework to upgrade Taiwan's economic security. And I think there are some features of the NSP. First, the NSP aims to become a multidimensional economic cooperation initiative that focuses on societal, cultural, and educational exchanges. And second, neither does the NSP pit itself against China, nor does it mention anything regarding shifting Taiwan's economic development in China, economic deployment in China to NSP countries. And third, the NSP emphasizes the most in enhancing the linkages and understanding among different societies and people, and it played a very, very low key about the strategic intent. But only few people will naively believe that the NSP had nothing about geopolitics and nothing to do with China. Although on the surface, the NSP does not appear to be a tool of economic security, in reality, it is strategically sensitive, targeting China. When U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Keith Krach, visited Taiwan lately, official talks involved integrating the NSP further into U.S. Economic Prosperity Network Initiative. The NSP is expected to collaborate with this U.S. initiative for promoting regional economic security, which is considered under China's threat in breaching economic freedom, openness, transparency, and fairness. So for the NSP to improve Taiwan's economic security, it at least involved three aspects. First, the NSP should diversify Taiwan's external economic opportunities and be free from the threats of China's sudden policy changes. Second, the NSP should gradually shift its economic dependence from China to the NSP countries. And third, the NSP should pivot Taiwan's foreign economic interest to the NSP countries. If the NSP is effective, all these three aspects should be manifest in the fields of trade, FDI, and tourism. So the following information will illustrate the macro effects of NSP on Taiwan's economic security in international trades, FDI, and tourism. And first, let me introduce the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, or HHI. This index is adopted in evaluating the concentration of Taiwan's external economic relationship. In trades, for example, this index is the sum of squares of trade shares of all Taiwan's trading partners. A high HHI indicates Taiwan's external trade relationship is very highly concentrated or very dependent on just only a few countries. And typically, an HHI of 15% or less suggests there's no serious concentration. 15 to 25 suggests moderate concentrations. Over 25% suggests a high concentration structure. So in this figure, figure one, the purple solid line measures the concentration level of Taiwan's exports with all trading partners. And the purple dashed line only includes Taiwan's trading partner in Asia. As you can see, the figure shows that Taiwan's total exports are moderately concentrated on a few global partners. But if we only look at the scope of Asia, Taiwan's exports are highly concentrated on just a few countries. And the concentration level increased the most significantly during the Chen Shui-bian administration from 2000 to 2008. And global export concentration reached a peak of 20.5% during the Ma Ying-jeou administration in 2010. And the NSP after 2016, when Chai Ing-wen was in power, does not alleviate the concentration level, which means that the NSP has insignificant effects on Taiwan's economic security in trade. As for Taiwan's imports, red line shows that no severe concentrations since 1996 can be detected. While figure one shows the concentration level, figure two illustrates the trends of Taiwan's exporting relationship with China and the NSP countries. Like anyone knows, Taiwan's most significant exporting destination is China plus Hong Kong and Macau, as the purple line shows. And the increasing dependence on China started to surge during the Chen Shui-bian administration and plateaued in Ma Ying-jeou and Tsai Ing-wen governments, and there is no sign that the dependence has decreased during the NSP period. And in fact, as the red line shows, Taiwan's export share with all NSP countries has slightly dropped it during the NSP era. And figure 3 examines Taiwan's largest exporting and probably the most security-sensitive sectors, electronics. Among all electronics exports, integrated circuits or IC products are the most important. The IC industry has now become a focal point of China-US tech war. And Taiwan's IC companies are deeply involved, such as the TSMC and MediaTek. As the black solid line shows, Taiwan's IC industry relies so much heavily on China market. From 2016 to 2019, an average of about 57% of Taiwan's IC products went to China. And the number is even higher than the average of 50% during the Ma Ying-jeou administration. So in fact, in the NSP era, Taiwan's export share of IC products has been increased, but not to the NSP countries. It is important to observe whether the structure will change after the recent reconfiguration of global supply chain in electronics. So far, as this macro trend shows, the deployment of Taiwan's IC industry may have jeopardized Taiwan's economic security the most. And now let's turn to the FDI. The HHI of Taiwan's FDI inflow shows no serious concentration, as shown in the purple line. However, HHI of FDI outflow, the red line, demonstrates a significant concentration on a few countries, notably China. This trend reached its peak in 2010 under the Ma Ying-jeou government. In 2010, 83.8% of Taiwan's FDI went to China. After 2010, the concentration level went down continuously. In the NSP era, about 40% of Taiwanese investment go to China, while about 15.5% went to the NSP country. Although structural change can be observed, but dependence on China remains high. The last dimension examines tourist economy. It is known that Beijing started to restrict the number of Chinese visitors to Taiwan after 2016, and such action was considered harmful to Taiwan's domestic economy. The HHI index in this figure shows that Taiwan's economic interest resulting from tourists around the world has moderately concentrated, and the concentration level was climbing during the Ma administration. The number of total tourists was also rising, and during the NSP era, concentration level was going down, which was caused by a sharp drop in the number of Chinese tourists. However, the total number of tourists continued to grow. The last figure shows that although the percentage of tourists from China remains the most significant, but the share has been declining during the NSP era. This dropping percentage was partly supplemented by tourists from the NSP countries. The amount significantly increased, especially tourists from the Southeast Asian countries. So according to the data presented above, here are some thoughts to provide. First, Taiwan's trade dependence on China remains very high, especially in critical sectors like semiconductors. Second, our FDI remains highly concentrated on China's market. These two aspects show that Taiwan's total deployment of its IC industry is a critical dimension for Taiwan's economic security. Taiwan should seek to diversify its electronics industry and actively participate in the current reorganization of the global supply chain. Third, the only observable improvement of Taiwan's economic security occurs in the societal and personal interaction, the diversification of worldwide tourists. Although tourists from China is decreasing, the number of tourists from other countries is rising. Fourth, Taiwan needs to lower its still very high reliance on China, but the NSP has not yet improved Taiwan's economic security. And that's all I want to share with you today. Thanks very much.
Well, Dr. Chun, thank you for an excellent presentation. I am particularly found interest in your HHI measure and of concentration, and think it's very useful. And the data you provide are, I'm sure, going to provide some grist for subsequent discussion. While I have the opportunity, before introducing our next speaker, I just want to say you can avail yourself of the chat function, the participants, and ask questions as they come to you. And hopefully we'll have plenty of time and plenty of questions. So in any case, I hope you'll do that. Finally, let me introduce Dr. Jonathan Pryke. He's written on the arms race in foreign aid in the South Pacific. He's at the Lowy Institute and heads their Pacific Island program. So, Dr. Pryke.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, and hello from down under here in Australia. As said, from the Lowy Institute. We're Australia's leading foreign policy think tank based in Sydney, but I'm actually talking to you today from a hotel room in Canberra in between meetings with our foreign affairs officials and members of parliament. So I think this is the first call that I've done for about 6 months, not in my living room. And so you will unfortunately not get to see my cat today, but I'm sure I hope to make my presentation interesting nonetheless. So I'm here today to talk to you about a part of the world you likely haven't paid much attention to, the South Pacific, and to discuss the role aid has played as a geopolitical tool in the rivalry between China and Taiwan. Since the Second World War, the Pacific Islands has been a relatively geopolitically benign part of the world. For the better part of the last 70 years, these 14 Pacific Island nations, spanning across 15% of the world's surface with a combined population of only 13 million people, has largely gone overlooked on the global stage. Australia, New Zealand, and France, with the support of Japan and the United States, have been the primary foreign powers in the region, anchored to it by ties of culture, geography, history, and in some instances, controlled territories. But bubbling under the surface of this perceived calm in the Pacific has been a bitterly fought contest for diplomatic recognition between China and Taiwan. This is so fierce that even just last week, in Fiji, a country that recognizes China, there was a unofficial Taiwan Independence Day celebrations where Chinese officials showed up and started taking photos of guests. And there was actually a brawl between the Chinese diplomats and the Taiwanese officials that left one of the Taiwanese officials in hospital. So this bitterly fought contest is still being bitterly fought today. But for decades, through gestures of goodwill, briefcase diplomacy, and legitimate development assistance, China and Taiwan have worked to pick off the other's diplomatic allies to varying degrees of success. Before 2019, there has been little movement over the years of support in the Pacific. In a major win for Taiwan, Kiribati switched its allegiances in 2003. Nauru briefly recognized China in 2002 before swapping back in 2005. But for the most part, despite the fierce competition, a status quo has existed in the Pacific, with 8 sovereign Pacific states recognizing China and 6 recognizing Taiwan. For Taiwan, the support equated to anywhere between a quarter and a third of all of their diplomatic allies around the world. And while there had been little change in alliances in the past 30 years, there had been significant investment from both sides in maintaining relationships in the Pacific. This century, however, the growing economic, diplomatic, and trade footprint of China in the region has led to a profound shift in the geopolitical equilibrium of the South Pacific. Now, there's long been a Chinese presence in the Pacific region, and significant pockets of ethnic Chinese have resided in the Pacific for more than a century. Some of the oldest trading houses across the Pacific region originate from China's Fujian province. This century, however, China has significantly scaled up trade, aid, diplomacy, and commercial activity in the Pacific. By 2018, China has emerged as a top 3 two-way trading partner for most Pacific Island nations. If you exclude Papua New Guinea, it is the largest trading partner for every other Pacific nation. China has also dramatically scaled up its aid activities. As of 2018, China was the 3rd largest donor to the Pacific region, contributing around 8% of all foreign aid to the Pacific between 2010 and 2018. While China is by no means the dominant power in the Pacific, Australia gave 5 times as much aid over that period as China did. The way in which China delivers aid through large infrastructure projects funded by concessional lending makes these projects stand out. Chinese lending has also been used as a vehicle to get Chinese state-owned enterprises into the region. These companies have put down deep roots and are now competing in commercial activity across the board. According to China's own investment statistics, Chinese construction activity in the Pacific was close to $1 billion in 2017, almost six times greater than its foreign aid activities in that year. A significant influx of Chinese migrants also mirrors growing Chinese commercial activity. Arriving on fishing vessels or to work on construction sites, many entrepreneurial Chinese citizens have been enticed by the commercial opportunities that the high cost and low competition economies of the Pacific represent. While official statistics are limited, anecdotal evidence and my own observations traveling throughout the region suggest that no significant town in the Pacific lacks a shop run by a Chinese migrant selling cheap Chinese goods. These entrepreneurs, while motivated by commercial and not directly under, while motivated by commerce and not directly under the influence of the Chinese state, serve to increase the perceived Chinese presence in the, on the ground in the Pacific. Even in the Solomon Islands, who still maintained diplomatic links with Taiwan up until late 2019, the Chinese presence had become so overwhelming through logging, retail, and construction that that the Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare stated in September 2019, just before the swap to Solomon Islands, that to be honest, this is quotes from the Prime Minister, to be honest, when it comes to economics and politics, Taiwan is completely useless to us. While Taiwan has been unable to match China's commercial engagement and migrant inflows in the region, it has in the past and still to this day vigorously used its aid program to build and maintain relationships and support in the Pacific. Taiwan's aid program is guided by its 2009 White Paper on Foreign Aid Policy. The primary stated aim of aid in this document is promoting friendly relations with diplomatic allies. Besides working to bolster its diplomatic relations, Taiwan's white paper emphasizes that providing aid is a means for Taiwan to share its development experience and give back to the international community, with a focus on basic infrastructure, technical assistance, humanitarian assistance, and education and training. The white paper is bolstered by the new southbound policy introduced by President Tsai in 2016, which emphasizes the shared cultural and linguistics links between Taiwan and its Pacific partners. It is under these frameworks that Taiwan's aid in the Pacific is invested. Now, I've got a few graphs that you can see in the report, but I'll just rush through exactly what the landscape of Taiwan's aid to the Pacific looks like. But up until 2019, the Pacific nations that supported Taiwan, Kiribati, the Marshall Islands, Nauru, Palau, the Solomon Islands, and Tuvalu, had a combined population of just under 800,000 people, three quarters of which are based in the Solomon Islands. In the past decade, these countries have received significant development support from Taiwan. By our own estimates at the Lowy Institute, over the US $371 million was given to these countries between 2010 and 2018, distributed across 395 projects. This support makes Taiwan the 10th largest aid donor to the Pacific and the fifth largest when isolating to the countries it has retained formal relations with. In certain countries, Taiwan is one of the most significant donors. For example, in Palau in 2016, Taiwan was the largest donor as the US withheld funding from its Compact of Free Association agreements for that year. While the Solomon Islands received the largest share of aid from Taiwan between 2010 and 2018, it also retains 75% of the population of the countries that retain alliances with Taiwan. On an average annualized per capita basis over this period, Tuvalu was the greatest beneficiary from Taiwan, receiving on average $500 per capita per year from Taiwan, with Solomon Islands the lowest, receiving on average $188 per capita per year. So there's clearly no alignment between the amount of aid delivered to a nation and its relative size. But this is actually a trend mirrored by many nations with regards to their aid programs in the Pacific. In many ways, Taiwan has worked hard to emulate its aid program around traditional OECD donor principles and standards, though its assistance to the region has not been without criticism. Furthermore, Taiwan has worked hard to make its aid distinct from that provided by China. So how does Taiwan's aid compare to China's? Well, between 2010 and 2018, China provided four times as much aid to the Pacific nations it maintains bilateral relations with than Taiwan with its own partners. While the absolute numbers are clearly in China's favor, when you look at per capita figures, Taiwan shoots ahead. On average over this period, Taiwan spent $46 per capita per year in the countries it maintains diplomatic relations with, compared to $20 from China, more than double. China also distinguishes itself from China in that the majority of its aid to the Pacific is through concessional finance, so there's cheap loans that then must later be paid back to China. Two-thirds of Chinese aid comes in the form of concessional finance to the Pacific. So when comparing only grants, so just one way, we give you the money, you never need to give it back. When just comparing grants, China gave $588 million in this period compared to Taiwan's $371 million. China's use of loans in the Pacific has sparked a heated debate about China's objectives in the Pacific, with many accusing China of engaging in the so-called debt trap diplomacy in the Pacific. While the subject has garnered a lot of attention around the world, a comprehensive assessment authored by myself and other colleagues at the Lowy Institute last year, which I encourage you to go find on the internet, concluded that China has not been the primary driver behind rising debt risks in the Pacific, although a continuation of business as usual would risk future debt problems in several countries. China's and Taiwan's aid also differ in the size of individual projects. Between 2010 and 2018, China implemented 197 projects with an average project size of $9 million. Conversely, over the same period, Taiwan implemented 395 projects with an average project size of under $1 million. So Taiwan's presence in the Pacific tends to generate less attention than China's for three reasons. The first is the way in which Taiwan operates on a smaller scale through grant-based financing, often focusing on small-scale infrastructure, people-to-people links, technical assistance, compared to China, which is focused on infrastructure, think government buildings, think roads, think wharfs, think ports. Taiwan's average project size in the Pacific is around 10% that of China's and half that of Australia's. Where China is very focused on highly visible large infrastructure projects, Taiwan's assistance is very spread out. The second is that Taiwan, unlike China, has not used this aid program as a vehicle for the Chinese diaspora and private sector to take root in the Pacific. And finally, Taiwan's presence in the region does not resonate with the broader narrative being discussed in Western capitals around the world about how to deal with a new Chinese-driven multipolar world. That isn't to say Taiwan's engagement hasn't been unnoticed. It has significantly impacted lives of those in the Pacific, and in some cases, profoundly. The clearest case of where Taiwan aid has had profound impact on development in the Pacific is its support of constituent development funds provided to the Solomon Islands, which was until 2019 the primary mechanism for Taiwanese support to the Solomon Islands. These CDFs were essentially discretionary funds allocated to each of the country's 50 MPs for investing in their electorate with minimal oversight. Many people on the ground call them political slush funds. Taiwan, between 2010 and 2019, Taiwan invested over $107 million into these funds. Solomon Islands politicians liked these funds so much that they have now allocated around one third of the development budget of Solomon Islands, or between 10 to 15% of the total budget of Solomon Islands to these constituent development funds. In this regard, Taiwan's aid program has contributed profoundly changing and perhaps undermining public financial management and what was its largest supporter in the Pacific. These CDFs are so controversial that China, who committed to maintaining the support for them as part of the deal to secure Solomon Islands support last year, is actually finding it difficult to convince parts of their own bureaucracy to disperse these funds, as they may too directly contravene President Xi's anti-corruption campaign. On the broader impact of Taiwanese aid, well, it's difficult to assess. While Taiwan has adopted many of the principles of traditional OEC donors, it does not engage in assessment of its aid projects, at least not publicly. While most donors will conduct evaluations of their projects over a certain size, this does not appear to be the case with Taiwan. This may be justifiable for the Taiwan government, considering their overall stated objective is to promote friendly relations with diplomatic allies. It could be argued that the best way to do that in the long run would be to provide effective and sustainable development assistance. So if Taiwan's stated aim is to maintain its relations in the region and build support among its diplomatic allies, then 2019 represented a significant failure of these objectives. Since the election of pro-status quo President Tsai in 2016, China has made assertive efforts to lure away Taiwan's remaining diplomatic allies, usually with considerable financial incentives. With the late 2019 defections of Kiribati and Solomon Islands, a total of seven nations have swapped allegiances to China since 2016, leaving Taiwan with a total of 15 states that recognize their sovereignty, including four in the Pacific. While Taiwan has no doubt built goodwill and strong relationships across the region, this can only go so far in the face of growing Chinese commercial presence and the incentives seemingly offered through interlocutors in the private sector and Chinese embassies in the region, such as in Port Moresby, the capital of Papua New Guinea. The limited focus on large-scale infrastructure has also bred resentment in some Pacific nations, notably the Solomon Islands. A parliamentary bipartisan task force responsible for assessing Seoul's bilateral relations with Taiwan complained that Taiwan will not do anything substantial in infrastructure development to support the economic growth of Solomon Islands. Ultimately, the deciding factor for the swaps last year was money. Taiwan appeared reluctant to provide more financial support on top of the already very generous sums that it has invested to maintain these diplomatic relations in the past. China apparently had better offers through the provision of loans, major infrastructure projects, replacing existing Taiwan commitments and other inducements. This money, however, doesn't appear to have yet come through in the volumes that Kiribati and Solomon Islands might have expected. With COVID-19 wreaking economic devastation across the region and China so far largely missing in action in the South Pacific in 2020, Kiribati and Solomon Islands may come to regret their decision sooner than many may think. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Pryke. And I found it particularly interesting in passing, you mentioned the Chinese diaspora and the implied there was a difference between the PRC approach and the ROC approach. So I think that could spark some questions along the way. We now have the privilege of hearing from Dr. Tom Finger, who's Shorenstein APARC Fellow. And I neglected to mention he has a new book out with Gene Oi, an edited volume called Fateful Decisions, and I recommend it to you all. In any case, Tom, we look forward to your comments.
Thank you, Mike, and my thanks to Glenn Tifford and Larry Diamond for the invitation to participate in this conference. I'm delighted to be a part of the discussion. I'd like to begin by commending the three presenters and paper writers. The subject of economic interdependence or use of economic leverage or economic coercion by the PRC, not exclusively by the PRC, but has become a very fraught and charged topic. Most discussions are filled with bombast and devoid of facts. But all three of the papers that have been presented today are very notable for the balance, the objectivity, and the empirical approach to an often fraught issue. And in that regard, I think they are an excellent contribution to the discussion of a topic that has now become justification for, among other things, arguments for decoupling from China by the United States and other economies. In the time that I have available to me, I'm not going to comment on the individual papers. I think it's more useful to consider the lessons that derive from the three of them taken together, because they do speak to one another quite effectively by looking at different dimensions of essentially the same phenomenon. So in the brief time available, I'm going to focus on five lessons or findings or implications of the three papers taken together. Before beginning that discussion, I would note that looking at the issue of dependence, vulnerability, levels of acceptable risk, it's quite appropriate to begin the discussion from and on Taiwan. Because though this is a new issue in the United States, or a relatively new issue here, Taiwan academics and businessmen and politicians have been devoting and debating this issue since 1979, when Beijing first proposed establishment of what were then called the three links, one of which was trade. That it's not a new issue. One would expect deeper understanding, greater experience from the actors on Taiwan. Let me begin with the first of the broad points that I'd like to underscore. First has to do with the relationship and the conflicting interest at times of governments and companies. Simply stated, the governments and companies evaluate risks differently. Both want to minimize and mitigate vulnerabilities, but concerns about national security are not the same as calculations about competitiveness and profitability. It's easy to observe that companies and governments view the issues differently, weigh the various dimensions of risk differently. But the importance of the private sector or of state affiliated firms to reduction or increases in vulnerability makes it imperative to ask questions about how much government control can be exercised, especially in democratic societies, over the private sector, over the decisions of more or less or highly independent boards of directors with fiduciary responsibilities to shareholders. None of our participants argue that there ought to be more or there ought to be less, but the papers point out that government policy in the area of reducing or deepening vulnerability and dependence is largely executed by private sector firms. The second broad point that I derive from the three papers is one confirmation that China has attempted to use economic leverage or coercive economic dependence to achieve political objectives. But the findings dig deeper than that. And these are findings that I think are correct, that Beijing has done so most often when issues that it defines as involving sovereignty are involved. It's a relatively narrow slice of all issues of which it has differences with partner states or societies or companies. A second observation, again, I think it is correct, is that in exercising this leverage, Beijing has endeavored to minimize the possibility of damage to Chinese interests, Chinese firms, Chinese workers, Chinese image. This is a government that does a great many things in a ham-handed fashion. And that certainly applies in this arena. But I think it's accurate that they've tried in their calculation and in the execution to avoid shooting themselves in the foot or some other part of the anatomy. The third observation about the way China has used this leverage is that it's not been very successful. Not only has it failed to achieve the announced or imputed objectives, but it's generated substantial blowback, damage to China's international image, damage to the image of the regime among the parts of the population that pay attention to such issues. It's triggered efforts at portfolio distribution. I think that derive more from the calculations of businesses about the danger of single point of failure, vulnerabilities of supply and supply chains, than it does to government pronouncements and encouragement. But the fact of the matter is that the China plus one, China and somewhere else for the next round of investment, has become a reality. The third observation or lesson based on the three papers together is that Taiwan's effort to reduce dependence on the PRC through calls for diversification, through calls for reorientation southward, as a matter of a Tsai Ing-wen government's policy, have also not been very successful. This arguably is puzzling, because as I noted at the beginning, these issues have been debated in Taiwan for 40 years. And the measures taken to defend against or mitigate against vulnerability so far have not been very successful. Firms have not significantly redirected their activities or diversified production or supply chains. Just in passing, I wonder, as I believe Professor Chun would wonder, implied by his observation that things may change as production and supply chains reoriented, that the huge amount of Taiwan exports that go to the PRC that consist of semiconductors, the vast majority of which are intended for incorporation into consumer and industrial products that are not going to stay in China. They're going to go to Europe, to Japan, to North America. And I would anticipate that as production chains reorient and some of that final assembly takes place outside of the PRC, Taiwan exports are going to become more diversified, not because of government policy, but because of corporate decisions. Second observation about the limited success as described in the papers is the policies to interest or encourage firms to look southward and to make Southeast Asia more interested in Taiwan economic engagement have not yet yielded very much. On one hand, it doesn't surprise me very much, but I think there are many questions that deserve to be asked, and I suspect our participants may have looked at some of these. Have overseas Chinese communities been targeted? Not because they're Chinese so much as because they are in key positions in the economies in Southeast Asian countries. And is it a function of the individuals, the companies they represent, the activities that are already heavily committed on the mainland, or because they fear the use of economic leverage by their partners on the mainland? The fourth broad point concerns the United States and the United States policy. One of the papers called on the United States to take steps to reduce the vulnerability of Indo-Pacific partners, vulnerability to the use of economic leverage. That immediately raises the question of why and how. I link this to the observation that US sanctions imposed on China, specifically, but not exclusively, those directed at Huawei, appear from the evidence I've seen and from the presentations to have done more harm to the Taiwan economy and Taiwan firms than the policies of Beijing have done to the Taiwan economy. But raising questions about whether or how Washington policymakers should factor into their calculations impact on Taiwan or possible impact on Taiwan, and should tailor American policies in a way that protect interests on Taiwan, even if they diminish the ability to achieve other American objectives. The final observation has to do with examples of Taiwan efforts to reduce dependence on the PRC and redirect economic activity southward, maintain diplomatic ties in the South Pacific. That the announced political objectives, as demonstrated by the speakers in their papers, have failed, or they've been less than fully successful, or they haven't been very impressive in the amount of success they have. But I suspect that the political objectives were not the only ones that were being pursued. And let me illustrate that or by asking questions about the South Pacific. The aid programs clearly were intended, as have been similar programs in Central America and earlier in Africa, in this competition for diplomatic recognition. But their aid projects that also, as with all aid programs from all countries, are intended to do things for the economy of the providing country, to improve the education, the health, living conditions, economic opportunities in the recipient country. Similarly, the policy to look southward that hasn't changed business, but has it improved, strengthened people-to-people ties? Has it moved beyond the ethnic Chinese to ethnic Chinese into the broader communities in these countries in ways that will bring longer-term benefits to Taiwan and to the partner countries? And finally, in pursuing these policies, beyond the hortatory aspect, what instruments have been used by the government in Taiwan? Tax incentives, subsidies to companies that are willing to do things, that the wide range of instruments that are available to governments to influence economic decision-making were not mentioned in these papers. There's a question of whether they were considered and not deemed appropriate or effective, were attempted and judged to have not worked and been dropped. My emphasis as I close on unanswered questions is not a criticism. Any good paper should stimulate interest in further work, questions for further study, and the people who have written the papers we've discussed this evening certainly are capable of doing work from which we will all benefit if they stick with these topics. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tom, and I certainly agree with your presentation, but particularly the opening comments on the quality data and objective character of the papers. I think that they were interesting and provide a great basis for discussion. Also, let me remind people they can use the Q&A function and submit questions. And we are allowing the last 15 minutes at least for audience questions. So hope you'll avail yourself of that opportunity. We're now going to move into a period of 10 or so minutes of the opportunity for the panelists to respond to questions that each might pose the other. And I'll take the advantage of the moderating role to throw out the first question to the panelists, but I hope you'll follow up on your colleagues' comments or elaborate on your own as the opportunity presents. It seems to me that we haven't talked too much. In a way, the interdependence that exists across the Taiwan Straits, to oversimplify a little, is actually triangular or quadrilateral in character. You certainly have as big players Japan and the United States. And I guess my question is, what effect is the United States and or other countries such as Japan, if they loosen up their supply chain, diversify away from China, throw on export controls, determine what intermediate products can go to China, what impact is that going to have on Taiwan, and what strategy do you have to deal with that?
Well, I might jump in from the Australian perspective here, because the economic diversification is the great debate being had in Australia right now. You know, we are one of the most economically interconnected nations in the world with China. 30% of our two-way trade goes to China. And so, yeah, everyone talks about, well, we just need to diversify. And, you know, it's much easier said than done. Everyone says we need to do it, but no one says how. You know, a lot of the rump of our trade relationships with China is in the extractive industries, iron ore, coal, and there's just, you know, there's not other markets out there for that. But then also, you know, wine, beef, barley, all these, China is just such a large and demanding economy of our resources that we don't have complementary partners elsewhere. You know, we talk about India, we talk about Europe. But the reality is that it is a much easier thing to say economic diversification than it is to do. And so we are really grappling with this conundrum. And I can't speak to how this may benefit Taiwan, but it is something that Australia is working very assertively to try and diversify our reliance or codependence on the Chinese economy. But I think the reality is that for many, many years, the trade relationship is going to dominate the relationship. And it's very hard to unpick this interdependence.
Yeah, I think I can also jump in to share my thoughts on this possibly, you know, interconnected relation within Taiwan as a country in Asia Pacific and how they will interact with the United States and China. So since this conference that's supposed to take place in the United States, I will just say something about how would this interdependence and how would the United States should respond to, you know, U.S. allies such as Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. There have been suffering from China's economic coercion. I think China's use of economic coercion certainly has an implication for the United States, most likely now or even more significant over the next 5 or 10 years. So even if China has generally refraining from targeting a coercive measure against the United States right now, but I think China can still shape the action and preference of U.S. allies. For example, I think a country in East Asia are considering a closer military relation with Washington over the next several years are certainly to consider a way in China's coercive economic measure. South Korea, after the Thet deployments, one example in case. I think countries such as South Korea, Japan, or even Taiwan will have to assess whether they wanted to bear the potential economic cost from China as a price of seeking deeper security tie with the United States. So even though this country might choose to pursue a closer economic relation with the United States, despite the potential cost, economic loss, they will still likely to factor in the possibility of China economic coercion into consideration. Right? These countries may even try to express assurance, or they might want to demand stronger security commitment from the United States for compensation if they are targeted by Beijing. Therefore, such consideration might raise the cost for Washington's in providing security commitment for individual country and also for East Asian security order in general.
Other commentary? On that question, we've talked about the diversification of efforts of Taiwan, obviously, and it's had limited success according to Dr. Chun's research. We talked about the U.S. and its considerations, but what's notable is the Chinese themselves are moving towards their plenum later this month, and it looks like, to me, they're going to emphasize a certain degree of self-reliance. They're calling it dual circulation. But it seems like all the parties to this massive game are each trying to reduce their dependence on others, in the first case, in strategic areas, and then diversify whatever external dependence they have to have. So I guess my question is, China may go towards self-reliance in a way that it hasn't gone for the last 40 years.
I think the reorientation of Taiwan's external economic tie is surely not just about Taiwan and United States. You have to consider about the behavior of important original partner, for example, like Japan, Australia, and South Korea. And all these countries are also highly dependent on China's market. So I think for Taiwan or also the United States, if they're trying to push the reorientation of the global supply chain, they have to make sure that they have collective interest to do so. Because as you can see, even though the United States government, they have a ban on exporting to Huawei or other sensitive company, Taiwan has some of the Taiwan's most important IC design company like MediaTek have been filing application not to follow the export ban. And also there are several large Japanese company like Sony, they're doing the same things. So if I think the government, they're not building a very good environment and searching for the alternative for these large private companies, if they're not selling their products to their largest buyer to China, so how can they survive in the futures? So I think collective interest is a very important thing that I think Taiwan, U.S., and all the regional partners should have to focus on what to do next. So that's my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any of the panelists that want to raise a question with one another, or I'll ask one final one before we segue to the audience participation. But anybody on the panel wish to say anything? Well, let me just go ahead. I heard that somebody started.
I would like to just pose the question to the three paper writers. Do you disagree with any of the general lessons that I extracted from the three papers taken together? Do you think I had anything fundamentally wrong?
I think in general, I agree most of the comment, especially when you talk about if Taiwan trying to reorient its external economic tie, it's not going to start from the government policy, but I should start from the corporate decisions. So I think the most important part for the New South Wales policy, maybe it's not to do anything about the governmental policy from above. It should be like the government are trying to build a really solid foundation to serve the relationship between Taiwan and the New South Wales policy countries. So I think that's why the government, the Thai government, are very emphasized on the people-to-people societal linkages and also educational exchanges. The government have doing a lot of educational exchange programs among university students. I think that will be a basis for, you know, to further improve the relationship in the societal level. And I think that will be facilitate in the future. It's not going to be a very short-term effect, but I think in the long term, that will influence the corporate decisions and, you know, the private, not public sectors. So that's my thought. Thank you.
Any other comments relevant to that question or entirely different comments? I guess I would just segue into the wider audience Q&A with an observation, perhaps simplistic, but I think if we look back to at least some of the conceptualization about interdependence, say in the preceding 30 plus years, I think at least some people, I'd probably include myself, thought economic interdependence would provide some incentives for Beijing to be restrained. Of course, we needed deterrence of a security nature and other things. No one thought that would be enough. But on balance, we thought interdependence was a restraining consideration. And I guess my question, in light of recent developments, the last, let's say, 5 or more years, do we think that anymore? Is interdependence a sort of enhancing security as taken as one variable? Or is it irrelevant? Or is it under certain circumstances restraining, but not all? Because it seems to me what we're talking about is a process of declining interdependence between Taiwan and the mainland. And if it's has some restraining character, then how are we going to make up, in some sense, that becomes a security provocation. So I'm just wondering, do we think this attempt to diversify and securitize, as Christina called it, is this going to enhance stability or decrease it in the region?
Yes, so I can just jump in briefly, address your question. First of all, I think you proposed a really great question about the concept of economic independence and how would that speak to the future Asian security order. I would just say that maybe we need to think about another way to approach the concept of economic interdependence. Maybe we should, as a scholar or policymaker, East Asian security should dig further to kind of, you know, unearth or investigate what's really going on in economic independence. Specifically, I think maybe think about the asymmetric relations between a stronger one and, you know, smaller or median one when they engage in this kind of sort of economic independence, right? What's behind the economic independence is kind of could be considered as a power asymmetry. In this case of China-Taiwan relations or China-Japan relation that I proposed in my paper, it's really about China being a dominant, you know, kind of like economic powerhouse in East Asia. Therefore, they create a kind of asymmetric relation in which Taiwan kind of having a stronger dependence on China's economic and the vulnerability of Japanese economics kind of drop into its lack of rare earth material. That's an important technology parts for its electronic industry or smartphone industry. So that's why I think in the future of the economic, in the future of study of East Asian security, one also needs to look at how a smaller or mid-sized country responds to this China's dominance and how would they use this power, you know, asymmetric relations to advance their national interests and promote a greater regional cooperation against a more assertive China.
Well, thank you very much. That was a perfect answer to segue into the first question I see here. This is a question for all of the panelists, and I hope you'll all jump in. The question is, how vulnerable is China's economic dominance in the region? And I'd editorialize and say so many people see China as a juggernaut, but China also has its vulnerabilities. How vulnerable do you see China being, especially given the increase in risky private investments and the heavy reliance on banks for development projects? What impact is this all going to have on social stability in China?
Well, can I add something to Dr. Lamson's previous questions about the interdependence?
Sure.
I certainly agree with Dr. Lai that the structure is a very important thing to consider, but I also want to add, as Taiwan, as a case study recently, I think that whether interdependence will stabilize the region or make the region more threatening, I think depends on the level of anarchy. For example, I think if you're considering Taiwan's situation like before 2016, I think definitely there's a kind of atmosphere in the society thinks that greater economic relationship with China, whether symmetrical or asymmetrical, probably will stabilize the cross-strait relations, because I think Chinese people has not sensed any level of security threats from across the strait. But I think after 2016, especially recent months, I think those kind of military threats become very imminent. So I think if the question is asked now, to me, I think I will compare with the previous era, I think I'll worry much about such kind of interdependence relationship, especially when the threat is very imminent. I would think the level of damage China trying to pose to the Taiwan's industrial deployment in China, I think that the threats will be very great in these days. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Another question Tom raised it in one of his lessons and sets of questions. It seems that the new southbound policy has not contributed to the diversification of trading partners and the outflow of FDI from Taiwan, but it is likely to produce effects, which was what I was speaking to, in the near future. But the basic question is, why has it been so difficult for Taiwan to diversify its outward investment and its exports to the PRC? And in light of those, it's been difficult. What does Taiwan have to do to improve its performance?
I think I'll let the other panelists respond to that question, but I'd like to take a whack at the previous one, which was is China a juggernaut or isn't it also vulnerable? Yeah. I'm firmly in the China is not a juggernaut, that the road ahead is going to be more difficult than the road that's been traveled. And just to flag a couple of the dimensions of the challenges that the mainland faces, that its miracle growth ended, flattened out earlier than that of the other Asian tigers, including Taiwan. That the super growth that elevated others into the highly developed country status, which is not just a matter of earnings per capita, it's system capacity to manage the ever more complex and interconnected and difficult challenges that come along with economic and societal modernization. So as growth slows, demand is increasing from a public with ever higher expectations. The fact that give or take 70% of the population of the mainland has no memory of any time other than the rapid growth of reform and opening. They have high expectations, they have high demands on the system. Meeting the educational, transport infrastructure, maintenance costs, healthcare, elder care, military, paying for the military they've already built, the the overseas involvement of Belt and Road and so forth, is going to take more money than they have. But the growth in money available is slowing. Reallocating among budgetary categories is going to be difficult. If the government needs more money as a percentage of total GDP, as seems imperative to meet looming expenses, that means there's less money available for individual consumers to build a consumer economy. That if they've got to save more for healthcare, or the government spends more on healthcare to take care of grandparents, there's less available for consumers. I'm not predicting that China's economy is going to collapse. I'm not predicting that the wheels fall off the system, but it's going to be very difficult. And that's going to make it more perilous for Beijing to exercise economic leverage in a coercive way.
I have an interesting question that relates to our discussion earlier. Is there any effective way for the government to shape decisions of private companies while they adhere to norms of the liberal international order? In other words, early on, it was commented upon that private companies don't always do what governments want. And therefore, there's limited capacity, particularly in a free market and democratic society, the leverage you can apply to your own companies. So I think this is an important question. How does one shape the behavior of private actors in a democratic system? And I would just observe to be corrected and educated, it seems to me that countries are tending towards more what I'd call industrial policy, that we might look in retrospect the last 30 years, sort of the idea of free market globalization, very favorably, but we're seeing the downsides, and government's going to play a bigger role, I would think, in most big economies in the next 20 years than the last 20 years. And I think you can even see that in our own election campaign. If the Democrats were to win, then you would still have an impulse towards, I would say, more government involvement in the economy, including external investment in technology and so on. So generic question is, how in a free society do you shape company and other economic actor behavior?
From the Pacific perspective, it's a great question, and one that Australia is, the Australian government as a primary donor to the Pacific, is really grappling with. We see this, you know, there's this great fear of Chinese economic colonialism in the Pacific. You know, they're just taking over industries left and right. And we want to push back with Australian industry. But the reality is we're not set up like the CCP, like China. We can't force SOEs into the region. We don't have many SOEs to begin with. And the reality is we've come to the conclusion that it would cost a heck of a lot of money to get China, to get Australian businesses to take the risk appetite that Chinese businesses do to get into these countries. And it's just not worth the investment. We've got to focus on our comparative advantages, things that we can do that China can't. If we want to race to the bottom in crappy infrastructure projects in the Pacific, well, in 10 years' time, that's going to be to no one's benefit. But we might build influence in the short term. So we've got to focus on what we're good at, focus on what we can do that China can't, focus on, you know, labor mobility, cultural ties, support of governance, support of other strengthening other parts of the relationship, and not trying to compete with China on everything, because that's just going to lead to bad outcomes for our relationships in the region. On some other points, Australia, we always thought the economic relationship was the ballast in the relationship. You know, 5 years ago, we had the signing of a bilateral free trade agreement. It was a massive deal for Australia, you know, and it was seen as the bedrock of this relationship. Nothing can go wrong because we have this such a strong economic relationship. And now that's become the battleground. That's our vulnerability. That's where they hit us. You know, anytime we call for an independent COVID inquiry, they'll stop our barley imports. You know, it's a profound shift in a very short time that we're still grappling with. And China as a juggernaut, well, you know, that's a romantic thought, but I don't see China disappearing anytime soon in the Pacific. And I don't think it's good strategy to assume that our great strategic rival is going to be in decline anytime soon. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Other comments from our paper writers? Well, I see the bewitching hour is upon us. Glenn, is it over to you?
Indeed it is. Thank you very much, Mike and Tom, for your wonderful questions and remarks. And I thank the panelists also for excellent papers and for the questions and answers that they posed to one another. As the manager of this project on Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific region, I want to thank the audience as well for joining us today. We hope that you'll be able to attend the three remaining sessions in this conference, which will meet every Monday and Thursday, or if you're in Asia and Oceania, Tuesday and Friday, at the same time for two more weeks. Our next session, entitled PRC Influence and Interference, will examine the United Front, the fierce competition over control of the media in the Chinese diaspora, online disinformation and propaganda, and perceptions in the region about the competition for influence between China and the US. We'll see you in 2 days. Thank you very much.